The following program is made possible with grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the National Endowment for the Arts, because a great nation deserves great art. Additional funds from Saul and Stanley Zabar, in memory of their parents, Louis and Lillian Zabar, Russian immigrants who founded Zabar's more than 70 years ago. Zabar's, a New York landmark, supplies food and delicacies to New Yorkers and to the nation, on the web at zabars.com. Additional support from Edwin A. Goodman, Harvey and Thelma Reisman, the John L. Loeb Jr. Foundation, from Frost, Zelnick, Lehrman, and Zissou, specializing in intellectual property law for clients worldwide, on the web at frostzelnick.com, and from one anonymous donor.
This is Only in America, 350 years of the American Jewish experience. I'm Larry Josephson. You're listening to The Streets Were Paved with Gold, Part 1 of a journey through the Jewish Lower East Side of New York. Over 2 million Jews came to the United States between 1880 and 1920. Most came to Ellis Island. Once they landed and passed inspection, they settled on the Lower East Side of New York. In this program, we'll hear oral histories from people who lived on the Lower East Side at the turn of the 20th century. Some of these recordings are not up to today's technical standards.
The streets swarmed with Yiddish-speaking immigrants. The swing and step of the pedestrians, the voices and manner of the street peddlers, and 101 other things seemed to testify to far more self-confidence and energy, to larger ambitions and wider scopes than did the appearance of the crowds in my birthplace. From The Rise of David Levinsky by Abraham Kahan, 1917.
We know that it was crowded, but what's hard for us to understand is precisely how noisy it was.
Annie Poland, education director at the Eldridge Street Synagogue Project.
People walking down the streets would have been assaulted by all sorts of words coming from everywhere.
You'd get up every Sunday morning, and you'd hear the peddlers singing, Long Island potatoes, Finnefin, I think it was 3 cents a pound. Finnefin, Kim's vibe, Gierha, Gierha, Kim. It means, come on, women, quick, get the bargains and all. And that woke me up every Sunday morning. That was my rooster, my alarm clock.
On the pushcart, they sold everything, clothes.
Peaches, bandanas.
Household goods, candy.
Fish, books, pots and pans. Bras.
Groceries, food, everything under the sun.
Anything really but pork would be sold on the push carts.
One third of the Yiddish-speaking population of Europe came to America between 1880 and 1914.
Kenneth Lebo, who with Irving Howe wrote The World of Our Fathers.
Persecution was a primary motive. The assassination of Tsar Alexander II, which caused a series of pogroms.
I was born in the Ukraine, Russia, March the 2nd, 1901. They used to tell the story how news came from town to town that they're wrecking and burning houses and they're making a pogrom.
My mother said every year before Easter, the church used to say that the Jewish people need the blood of a Gentile man to make their wine. And so they made a pogrom. And they used to run in the streets and kill everybody. Women who were pregnant, they cut their bellies open.
In a small side alley, a peasant wearing a vest was smashing a window of a house. He was breaking the glass with a wooden mallet, swinging his whole body with it. The entire street was filled with the singing of cracking and splintering wood. The peasant was banging away until a procession appeared on the street carrying a portrait of the Tsar. Banners with pictures of saints on them flapped over the procession. The peasant in the vest pressed his mallet to his chest and rushed after the banners. Isaac Babel, the story of my dovecot.
There was a wave of horrible pogroms, particularly the Kishinev pogrom of 1903.
Tony Michaels teaches American Jewish history at the University of Wisconsin.
Then the wave, 1905, 1906, following the Russo-Japanese War, and then yet an even worse wave of slaughter of Jews in the Ukraine during the Russian Civil War, following the Bolshevik Revolution between 1918
and 1920. They were just awful. They took my poor brother, and they were beating him immerciful. I never thought he'd get out alive.
They would come and destroy him and burn, and how could you live in a place like this?
'14, the war broke out, World War I. All the men, they went to the army.
The war was just awful. I never saw the sunrise. We were always hidden.
Between 1914 and 1916, there was a trench war in our town. Then the revolution came, the most violent things you ever want to see. They used to grab people in the streets with the beards and cut them off.
They would take the dull side of the knife and try to cut the beards. Needless to say, some of them with the skin came off.
That's when we found out what the anti-Semites are.
Kenneth Lebo.
The idea of America had finally taken root by the late 19th century, and it was in many ways a fantastic idea that the streets of America were paved with gold.
Deborah Dashmore, professor of Jewish history at the University of Michigan.
Letters start to flow back to Jews who remained behind in Europe.
To my worthy wife, Marcia Mindel, and to my loving son, Susha Feifel. And to my precious darling daughter, the apple of my eye, the pride of my life, Tzipkele.
They talk about the abundance of food, for example.
First, I come to tell you that I am well and in good health. White bread and meat I eat every day, just like the millionaires. In America, there are no mud huts where cows and chickens and people live all together. Lastly, my darling family and people of the village of Sokovali, there is no czar in America. From Hungry Hearts by Anzia Jezierska, 1920.
My kings might rise before the bank, they say a zinagino.
One way in which the myth of America was perpetuated was that you could walk into a photography studio, you could rent a top hat, a gold-topped cane, a diamond stick pin, and a backdrop of Niagara Falls. You would have your photograph taken, and you would send it back to the shtetl. And they would say to themselves, my God, look at this guy who was the town idiot, and now he's a multimillionaire.
Und spiel mir a Lidl vom goldenen Land.
Jews of all kinds and classes came to America, the well-off and the not-so-well-off, ordinary people and intellectuals, Yiddish, Russian, and Polish speakers, Orthodox rabbis, and secular socialists.
The ones who would come first, which was often the head of the household, would send ship tickets once he had the money to buy them back home, and then the rest of the family would come.
We didn't take anything to America. We had nothing to take to America. All we had to take with us were some bad memories, which we gladly left behind us.
The journey to New York could take up to 2 weeks. Steamerships could hold 2,000 people, and they were usually filled to capacity.
Tremendous noises, great waves were smashed, the noise, tremendous.
We got on the boat, of course we went steerage. Steerage meant a horrible experience.
It was the lowest deck, it was very hot. There must have been anywhere from 200 to 300 people in that huge cavernous area. The body smells, the body odors, the lack of sanitation.
odors of paint, you had odors of food, people got sick, all these odors combined. We spent most of the time on deck.
The food was so bad that my father and I would sneak up to an upper class and we would steal from the garbage can pieces of meat, even though we were kosher, but we were so hungry that we took them.
On Friday nights, we Jewish women light our Sabbath candles, and the first Friday night they were aboard ship, they were Jewish women, put their candles. Naturally, it was a dangerous thing to do. That infuriated the sailors and all, and they'd walk around, you know, blowing out the candles, and they'd yell for Dumpty Juden, stupid Jews. You know, which really was a terrible thing to do.
I remember about 6 o'clock in the morning, the lookout said, "Land ahoy." Everybody rushed up on deck, you know, to see land, the first sign of America. There were a couple of thousand people. Everybody cheered, "America! America, my God!" Everybody's yelling, crying, kissing.
My father and I, we ran out to the deck, and there were people of all denominations, some on their knees making the sign of the cross, Jews in their prayer shawls. As we were passing the Statue of Liberty, it was the first time I saw it. It was a great sight.
Many immigrants came for relatively short periods of time and then returned. Jews, by and large, came and stayed. There was very little attraction to go back.
They had no allegiance to the country. They had left. They were ready to start in America.
The boat anchored in mid-harbor, and then they tendered us from the ship to Ellis Island, like a ferry boat. You took your suitcase and you, by the hundreds on the ship, you had to go back and forth a few times. The building was grimy.
A tremendous room with an awful lot of people and an awful lot of noise. And people from all kinds of countries with all kinds of languages that you didn't understand.
Thousands of people in here, sitting on the benches there, all lined up.
There were rumors that we would have to go through some kind of a physical or a health inspection. My brother and I, my mother, we weren't stopped at all, but my sister was detained for about 10 or 15 minutes. And we, having heard the stories about people being detained for health reasons, we were concerned that she might be sent back to Poland. But luckily, my sister came out and we all got a clean bill of health.
One doctor examined your hair, one doctor your eyes.
It was determined that I'm only 5 years old. My mother takes me along with the women in their area for the examinations. The picture is still clear in my mind today as I got into all these ladies and they were all stripped down to the waist. But I've never seen a woman stripped before.
By the turn of the century, when the immigrants were arriving at Ellis Island, most likely they knew someone already in New York. At the end of the process, there was a gate, the Kissing Gate. And it was called the Kissing Gate because it was there that immigrants were greeted by their family members. In some cases, it was their husbands that they hadn't seen for 2 or 3 years.
There's a big gate there. And I didn't want to go to my father. I didn't know him.
My father came to pick us up. My mother says to me, used to call me Meshi, was my Jewish name, now it's Morris. Meshi, she says, "This is your father." I said, "Hi, Pop."
There were cases where people arrived and, you know, husbands were somewhat embarrassed of what their wives looked like because they looked very old-fashioned. And the wives, in turn, were surprised by the husbands because they had shaved their beards.
Papa was so changed. I hardly expected to find him in his black long-tailed coat in which he had left home, but with the same full-grown beard and earlocks. Now instead, I saw a young man with closely cut beard and no sign of earlocks. Papa had been the most pious Jew in our neighborhood. I wondered, was it true that in America, one that once became a libertine? From Out of the Shadow by Rose Cohen.
Green one or greenhorn is one of the many English words and phrases that my mother tongue has appropriated in England and America. Green, in the sense of color, is Yiddish as well as English, so I understood the phrase at once. And as a contemptuous, quizzical appellation for a newly arrived, inexperienced immigrant, it stung me cruelly. From The Rise of David Levinsky by Abraham Kahan, 1917.
A green cousin came to me. She was beautiful. Her cheeks were red like oranges. I'm going to sing it in Yiddish. Zu mir ist gekommen a Cousine, schön wie gold ist sie gewesen, die Grüne.
Schön wie gold ist sie gewesen, die Grüne, die Becke lacht wie rote Pomeranzen, Fisseler, was beten sich zum Tanzen. Die Becke lacht wie rote Pomeranzen,
und Fisseler, was beten sich zum Tanzen. She came to this country, her voice was like she sang. She walked like she wanted to dance, you know. And then her neighbor had a millinery store and gave her a job. And when she started to work in the millinery store, the cheeks were not so red anymore.
And her eyes weren't so blue anymore. And she said, I wish Columbus wouldn't discover America. Everybody was singing when I came over.
Annie Poland.
When they arrived on the Lower East Side, they realized the streets certainly weren't paved with gold and life was extremely difficult.
Right now we're standing in the hallway of 97 Orchard Street on the first floor. My name is Steve Long and I'm the Vice President of Collections and Education at the Lower East Side Tenement Museum. We are going to be walking up the stairs right now, and we're going to head to the Levine apartment. A Jewish family. Originally, they lived about 35 miles northwest of Warsaw, and they came to the United States in 1890 and moved here to 97 Orchard Street. This apartment is about 325 square feet of space. When visitors enter, they stand in the kitchen. Behind them is a bedroom, only about 8.5 by 8 feet. And then the third room in the apartment is the front room.
Often there were up to 10 people living in a space like that. As memoirists often wrote, there was no privacy on the Lower East Side.
The first apartment I remember was one on Houston Street and Avenue B. First thing you saw was a kitchen, which my sister and I slept in, and there were pipes along the wall. And at night, a rat would come out every once in a while and walk on the wall next to me, you know. It was terrifying. I hated that place. I really did.
Zimmer bei Nacht auf die Dächer, dort ist a goldene Zeit.
Man läuft von dir und kennst die Lächer.
Okay, just give a rough translation.
Summer, you went on the roof because it was so hot. You felt like you were in a prison. So you went up on the roof. It was like a paradise.
Dort kommen nicht kein Polizleit. Dort kämen ton jede Sache. Ihr habt kein Schäns nicht gesehen, euch wir seid nicht gewähnt. Sommer bei Nacht auf dem Dach.
We had three rooms. And my mother said, we got too much room. So she took a boarder in, and the boarder would pay rent. They could sleep then. If they wanted to eat, they could eat with us.
There was always songs about the boarders. Ich bin schön wie der Single, pinkt das euch ein Engel. One man was married and he got divorced, so he was going to move out. His wife said, why should you move out? Be a boarder by me. So he became a boarder by his wife. He liked it so much because he can go whenever he wants because he's a boarder, you see. Ich bin a bord by my vibe.
Oh, ich bin a bord by my vibe. Männer, es tut das heire Job. Sie attendet mich mit alles, wenn ich gepflegt, ich ist alles. Ich bin a bord by my vibe.
Before 1900, it was expected that you would use an outhouse. There's very high rates of disease, for example, with infant mortality. Just reviewing the census of 1900, of the 20 families or so that are living here at 97 Orchard Street, they have about 100 children, and only 60 of those children survived infancy.
Jewish Daily Forward, June 26, 1905. Here is our doctor at the door of an apartment in 120 Delancey Street. The mother just gave birth to her first child. The two-room apartment is occupied by the father, mother, newborn child, and eight boarders. Can you imagine the horror and debasement of giving birth in the presence of eight strangers?
The most important housing law, I think, in American history is the 1901 Tenement House Act. It required three big changes. First was the addition of ventilation, light, air to the hallways. The second big change was that all tenements had to have access to indoor running water. And the third big change was the installation of toilets. Two toilets were put in on every floor of 97 Orchard Street. This 1901 law in New York led to legislation that was enacted in other parts of the country. These apartments become just a little bit lighter, a little bit airier. It means you're not going to the backyard to use the toilet anymore.
We did not have a toilet in the house. It was out in the hall, and my neighbor used the toilet, I used the toilet, and there were two stores in the front, and they used the toilet also, so everybody using that toilet. And my mother was the only one who was cleaning that toilet. That way she was, driving them mad.
In the kitchen was the bathtub next to the sink, and on top of the bathtub was called a tots, the huge porcelain cover that stayed on the bathtub all week long.
You bathed in that bathtub. You washed your clothes in that bathtub. I mean, that was a very important part of the bathtub.
After the turn of the century, the city set up bathhouses on the Lower East Side, and they could have thousands of visitors in a month, tens of thousands in a year. And the days that the bathhouses were used the most were actually Fridays, which is a testament to the continued importance of the Friday evening Sabbath.
If you've done any interviews with other people, I'm sure everybody has told you how wonderful it was and how marvelous and all. Well, I don't think it was that wonderful, truthfully. I think what was better then was the fact that we were younger and we still had our dreams. And then when you interview us now in the 70s and 80s, you realize that, well, some of your dreams came true, and others say, hey, this is it. So therefore, the old times always seemed better.
I think that when you were growing up in the tenements, you looked to other forms of satisfaction.
Historian Deborah Dashmore.
You could go to Coney Island and enjoy the beach.
I remember going to Coney Island. That was the only time my family was a real family. They closed the store on Sunday on a hot day, and my mother would bring hot flesh with sour pickles. You know, I've made that hot flesh. It's, you know, eggs and onions and lots of garlic, and you brine it. I can still taste it. It was my most wonderful time.
Most often, poverty registered in suddenly the diet becoming monotonous, no meat, just potatoes and other cheap vegetables.
We ate brains, we ate spleen, tongue, you ate everything because it was cheaper. And you always, we ate a lot of liver because the liver was supposed to go for the cats. However, we were the cats.
There was not always food. But somehow, I don't ever remember a Shabbos where there wasn't gefilte fish and chicken and soup and all of that. My father had a watch, a gold watch with a fob, and he would put that in the pawn shop every other week or so that would go in there for money, you know. And I would look at my father to see if he had his watch. That's how I knew when things were bad. Things were always bad. Things were always bad.
Linen, linen, miles of linen, stitching, stitching, cotton, pinning, with no end and no beginning. That's the form of the sewing machine.
Jews were concentrated in the largest manufacturing industry in New York, the garment industry. In the late 19th century, most of the garment manufacturers were German or Central European-born Jews. By the turn of the century, most of those Central European or German Jews were pushed out by Eastern European Jews. The manufacturers are almost all Jews. Most of their employees are Jews.
In some cases, they had been tailors before they came to America. And the way that it was set up in New York at that time, the jobs were so segmented that even if you hadn't had experience before you got there, it was something you could learn. This sweatshop could be a tenement apartment. So that same 300 square foot apartment that at night sleeps 10 people. During the day, the workers come with their sewing machines and they set up right in the house. The appeal of that type of shop was that it was familiar, in that you could be working for someone who was your neighbor in the city that you had come from originally. These shops also would not be open on Saturday, so if you were a Sabbath observer, you would prefer this smaller scale shop.
Five men and a woman, two young girls, not 15, and a boy who says unasked that he is 15 and lies in saying it, are at the machine sewing knickerbockers, knee pants, in the Ludlow Street dialect. The floor is littered ankle deep with half-sewn garments, the faces, hands, and arms to the elbows of everyone in the room are black with the color of the cloth on which they are working. There are 10 machines in the room. Every floor has at least 2, sometimes 4, such shops. Jacob Riis, How the Other Half Lives, 1890.
I worked at any trade you can think of, a dressmaker by hand and by machine a little bit. And then I worked at underwear, like brassieres, petticoats, nightgowns.
I went to work in this ribbon factory, putting a label on the top of a roll, what color the ribbon was and how many yards the roll had.
You were how old at this time,
Mr. Schultz? I was 14.
You're listening to The Streets Were Paved with Gold, part one of a journey through the Jewish Lower East Side of New York. I'm Larry Josephson. We'll be back in a minute.